I'm delighted to be here to call to order this session of our conference. I'm Lee Liberman-Otis. I'm one of the people who was involved in starting the Federalist Society, and I'm now the Senior Vice President and Director of our Faculty Division. I'm going to introduce Boyden Gray, who in turn is going to introduce our guest. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing Boyden Gray, partly because Leonard, of course, already introduced him this morning, and partly because I'm sure that everybody is eager to hear from both him and Justice Thomas. I do want to mention that we do have overflow rooms somewhere in that general direction if there are people who are looking for seats and would be more comfortable there. I think it's the Chinese room and something else, so you may want to be aware of that. I do want to tell one story about Boyden Gray, though. I worked for Boyden when he was counsel to the president, and as you probably, those of you who heard him this morning know, Boyden is something of an iconoclast. One morning, when he was working on a Saturday, he was busily working in his office, and he'd brought with him his daughter and her pet to the office because he could sort of get some work done and also keep an eye on her. One person who nobody ever crossed at the White House was a woman named Rosa Maria. You might ignore the directive of the chief of staff. You might ignore the directive of the counsel to the president, but you would not ignore Rosa Maria, who had been with the president for many years and who basically was in charge of saying all the things that you couldn't do at the White House. So Rose had some piece of business that she wanted to conduct with Boyden, and she was working on a Saturday, as was not infrequently the case with her either. And so she popped into Boyden's office. And there in Boyden's lightly furnished office was a gigantic Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. And this is the only time that anyone can remember Rose being at a complete loss for words. She looked at Boyden. She looked at the pig. She tried to utter some words, but none would come out. And she just threw up her hands and walked out of the room. Ladies and gentlemen, Boyden Gray.
Well, thank you, Lee. Thank you very much. You've already heard me speak, and you don't want to hear me. What you want to do is hear Justice Thomas. So I'm just going to have him get up here as soon as he can. The time is limited. I will say, though, that my boss constantly goes over these times of his confirmation, and I think, well, I don't know how his epitaph is going to be written, but I think he feels it was the best thing he ever did. So, Justice Thomas.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. Well, I feel like quitting while I'm ahead. Well, thank you all very much, first of all, for being out in such inclement weather and being a part of such a wonderful event and a wonderful organization. I'd like to thank Boyden, not only for introducing me, but for his kindness throughout the more than 25 years we've known each other, and especially during the confirmation where both he and the president were steadfast, firm, and courageous, I think. And I deeply, deeply appreciate that. I'd also like to thank Lee Lieberman, who not only is one of the founders of the Federalist Society, but was also central in my confirmation process, and who sort of, as Lee's character would suggest, very quietly behind the scenes did some of the very, very effective work and gave me some of the most important advice throughout that process. And this is an opportunity to thank her personally from the bottom of my heart for all that she has done. Lee, thank you. And my wife, Virginia, I feel badly sometimes. She is, she loves me even when I'm not so lovable. And throughout this long writing process, that was a lot of time. And she's been tireless and tenacious throughout. Some years ago, more than 20 years ago, I was sitting by myself and I said, you know, if I would ever be married, I'd like to be married with someone who understands that or who loves me during the difficult times and who is dedicated to being married during the worst times, not just the best times. And my wife has been steadfast and immovable and unshakable through some of the most turbulent and difficult times in our lives. And she is my best friend in the whole world. And I really will... And finally, I'd like to thank Gene Meyer and Leonard Leo for all the work they've done throughout. They've traveled all over the country and co-sponsored some fantastic events. And I also like to thank them for, through over the years, I appeared in this very room 15 years ago to speak at a Federalist Society event. And I like to thank them for giving me an opportunity to be involved in something very, very important. I've been on the court now 16 years, and it's kind of hard to say that. Just like, what has happened to my life? You almost want to say, yo, you need to go get a life. You know? But it's been an interesting 16 years, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to chat about that during the Q&As. But it's certainly has moved along more rapidly than I would like. But someone asked, and it's a question that I've been asked over the past few weeks, and that is, why write the book now? Well, if anybody knows anything about book writing, I didn't just write it now. It didn't just suddenly show up, you know. But over the past few years, it's certainly taken quite some time. One of the reasons I wrote this book was because so much has been written about me, and most of it's wrong. And even when people mean well, it's wrong. And it seemed to be required. I owed it to so many people, my grandparents, the people who were in my neighborhood, Miss Gertrude, Miss Beck, Miss Mariah, Miss Gladys. I think I owed it to them to give an accurate story of the way that we were raised, because they played such a critical role in all of that. I also thought it was important to so many people I've met over the years, people who have asked me about my life and who, when they found out that it had so many similarities to their own, they said, why don't you think of telling the story? And it's almost as though you owed it to them to say, look, here's my story, and it's very similar to yours. You know, it's really hard to talk up here when this guy in front of me keeps moving. I wonder if they could turn that out. I'd really appreciate it, but... At any rate, it's me. You sort of see yourself moving around. You say, oh. You just wonder, this guy keeps moving around in front of me. Gosh. But at any rate, I'll stop looking at this guy in front of me. But it's sort of, you look out there and you say, well, it's too much of a good thing if you think well of yourself. My goodness. But on the other hand, I have also wanted to provide some hope to people who are still trying to hope, people who are going through difficult times, their education or difficulties in their lives, that sort of thing. And on this score, it has been enormously rewarding to go across the country, far more rewarding than I could possibly have hoped. I met a Vietnamese lady in Atlanta, and she came up to me in tears and said that your story is my story. And I looked at her, and we're so different. She's this broken English. She obviously dreamt of being in this country and prospering here. It was so wonderful to see that she understood implicitly what I was trying to say, that there's so much in it about hope that is universal and about our lives that's general and universal. There was a man who came up to me the other day who grew up in a rural town in Iowa, and he said, "We grew up the same way. There's so much that's the same." Obviously, he doesn't mean we're exactly the same, but so much of it's the same. And there isn't a single person in this room who haven't had some of the challenges that I tried to deal with in the book as honestly as I could. And finally, I recently looked, this morning, I was looking at a letter from a black gentleman who said that he sat in his car and wept upon reading the book because it told him that he had taken the safe course by not expressing his own opinions, that he went along to get along. It is the safe course. And that, just hearing from these people, means that it's broken through the din that we all have known in Washington, D.C., the monopoly of certain organizations and certain groups and media types who for years would not allow the simple message to get through. So much of what is in that book is what we've said before. There's nothing new. There would have been no reason for the Federalist Society if the then predominant organizations had allowed open debate, open discussion, did not take hard position, had not become so ideologically closed that you couldn't talk anymore. I don't know about you all, but when I was in law school, we'd go get beer on Thursday, a dollar a pitcher. Boy, you could have a lot of good thoughts with that. But it was so wonderful to argue about things, to talk about them, to debate. And that's, by the way, my point in my discussion about John Bolton in the book. Here's a guy who's out his book now on the same thing. He may be seen as an iconoclastly, but he's not. He's just a person who decides for himself and has the courage of his convictions. And I think when people like that man who sat in his car and wept because he had not had the courage of his, when they see it, maybe they'll stand up and express it. That like the people like Lee, et cetera, who found this organization, Leonard and Gene, people running it and making it grow, that they have the courage of their convictions and still believe that ideas are worth putting out and having people debate them and discuss them and see them grow and strengthen and head in a certain direction. So in any case, the rewards of having written this book, I've already reaped. Far greater than anything I could have hoped for. And you all, each of you in this room, are part of that. The reason why those ideas got out. The reason you are the people who gave us hope. You are the people, the fact that you would have us here, that you would say it's good to think that you're here, that you see numbers of people who say, we're here not to be proselytized, but to think for ourselves. And at bottom, isn't that why one of the reasons we love a free society, that we get to think for ourselves, make our decisions based on certain principles, and to make it possible for others to do the same? So I thank you all, and I thank you for having me here, and I look forward to answering as many of your questions as time allows.
The first question is the job as wonderful as you thought it would be? And if so, what are the favorite aspects of it?
First of all, I never thought it'd be wonderful. Secondly, I never thought about it. You know, I was busy trying to survive the onslaught, but I really, quite frankly, never thought about being on the Supreme Court. Boyden thought about me being on the Supreme Court. And I never had a chance because of things that happened after the announcement. I never had a chance to think about what the job entailed. And it wasn't until I showed up and I saw that shelf full of briefs that I asked myself, what the heck have I gotten myself into? And of course, as I recount in the book, Senator Danforth, when coming into my office and looking at all those briefs and stacks of documents, he said, "Clarence, this looks really boring." But on a more serious note, I I still am so grateful that President Bush had confidence and faith in me to play such a role in this country. I've been asked this question in different ways about whether or not I'm having fun. You know, I have fun on my RV, and I have fun watching, well, not so much my football team anymore, but my poor Cornhuskers have had a hard time, but I enjoy watching football. That's fun. This is more important than fun. This is about having the honor of defending an ideal or trying to promote this ideal that's in the form of our Constitution and our country, and to protect that. So it's more in the nature of a mission. And if you want to see sort of, I take my clerks each year to Gettysburg, just so we can understand at the end of a term when you're tired and there may be a tendency to be a little bit cynical, although we never get that. We don't allow that in our chambers. We get to read to see where Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address and to see that mandate for us, the living, what we have to do. And it's very, very important. So it's a wonderful question, but I don't look at this kind of as a hobby or fun or anything. This is far too important for that. It's protecting and promoting an ideal.
You once said that everything good that has happened in human history was the result of liberty. Has this ever been at the expense of equality?
Oh, gosh. I don't think I've ever said we should have equality of results. I don't see how you can have that. In fact, I think I gave back in the 80s several speeches making that point. I think we were talking about our inherent equality, and then we were free to do as we were capable of doing and free to do, but the equality of results was not a part of it. That is something that would have to be foisted upon us, and what my point was then was that would be inconsistent with government by consent. So, but that's a long time ago. That's I would have to talk to that person to see what they mean by equality. I think it means different things to different people.
In what environment do you do your clearest and best thinking, and how do you create, ensure the continuation or the creation of that environment?
I think pretty well almost every place. I try to be as sober as a judge. It's been good life. I've got my best friend when I'm at home. I love being at home. I work at home a lot. My best friend's there. And we kind of have, it's a hoot. And so it's a wonderful, warm place to be home. So I can think there. And that's where I wrote the bulk of this book in my study at home, at my computer. I love being with my law clerks. It's just wonderful. And you talk to them, we laugh, we might go to, I don't go to Chinese restaurants as much because I'd gain so much weight, but I just love talking to my law clerks. I love talking to my former law clerks. I love talking to people on the street, on Walmart parking lots. I find that if you are positive and if you're open and honest, there'll be some ideas you can get from little kids. There's sometimes they can ask some of the most innocent questions that get you to thinking about some of the most complicated things that we do. Teaching a course, I teach a con law course, and some of the questions are so innocent and so straightforward, it just gets you thinking in a different way. So I can think driving my bus. I can think taking a walk or working out. So I think as long as I'm at peace inwardly, and as long as I am rested, there's really almost no place I can't think about things. And I think the environment that I ensure has to be that inner environment as opposed to the externalities.
Why do your colleagues ask so many questions during oral argument?
Thank you. Oh, finally. And I have to tell you, I did not plant that question. I know there's controversy about that these days, but I didn't plant that one. That is a fine question. And when you figure out the answer, you let me know. Because I have no idea. Because I think I've demonstrated over 16 years that you can do this job without asking a single question.
What is the most important thing to get out of law school?
I think a degree. I certainly, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, they say that I went to Yale Law School on affirmative action and that I got all those benefits. Well, if you couldn't get a job, what were the benefits? I always wondered, I'm trying to tally up all these benefits from Yale Law School. My God, student loans, there it is. I had a lot of student loans. I think that an ability to think through difficult problems and to honestly think them through and confidence that if you do it right, that you can arrive at a good answer, not the only answer, but an answer that's defensible, and be willing to not only defend that, but humble enough to hear the other side. So I would put a combination of sort of belief in your own abilities and that when you do things right, when you analyze things according to the rules and think things through clearly, you can arrive at a defensible conclusion, but also humility that maybe I don't have all the answers and the other person might be right. So if you see at the end of my dissents, I say I respectfully dissent. The respect is that I respect the right of the other person to come out another way. And I don't have the gospel. I just have opinions, and I try to defend them. But I think you can get that out of law school. And one of the problems that I've had with some of the things I've seen coming out of the law schools is that it borders on proselytizing. I don't think any of us went to law school to be proselytized. We went to law school to learn law. And that we were taught that there were different opinions and there were different approaches and there were different views. And I like that. Hence the arguments over a dollar a pitcher beer. If we were proselytized, we'd all be reciting from rote or in a rote way the same things. Instead, we were arguing and debating. I thought that was wonderful about law school. And probably the best thing I got out of Yale Law School was the chance to argue with other people, to debate them, to get confidence, to be sent back to learn something that you hadn't thought about before, and then come back rearmed and argue again. And one of those persons, I recount that about John Bolton in my book. And it was just a classic example of talking to a fellow student that changed my way of thinking because he challenged me. He didn't condescend. He challenged. And I had to figure out a response in an honest way. So I think one of the things you can get out of law school, again, confidence that you can learn and analyze and reach conclusions, humility that the other person might be right.
How does your commitment to natural law affect your judging?
I think I think it has helped in this way. And I don't know whether it's commitment is the right word. I'm not going to argue about that now, I don't think that's the right word. I think it is important to understand why the document is the way it is. It is really important to understand the natural law background. And that gives content to why there's separation of powers. It gives a content to the whole notion of government by consent. It gives content to enumerated powers and why there were limitations on the national government. And that ultimately the structure of the Constitution was to protect individual liberty. And with that background, you can look at the individual problems. But as far as using natural law to decide specific cases, that is not something that I have done and do not do. The Constitution is a written document, and I apply that document with the understanding of its origins.
Does the confirmation process as it currently operates affect the judicial justice system in terms of damaging the courts possibly or the public's perception of the judicial system?
I give you a short answer, yes. I think that we're doing great damage. I fear how much damage we're going to do to our judiciary over time. I don't know when it will collapse under the weight of what we're doing, but I think it has to at some point. My current chambers, actually I'm out of them now, but my permanent chambers are the chambers of Justice Byron White. And I enjoyed and considered it an honor to have served with Justice White for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons, of course, is that he had no agenda. He was just Byron White, smart, fair, good man, and also he's a legend. He told me that he was nominated, sworn in 10 days. Now, if that process worked for 200 years, why did we change it? And if it gave us the judiciary that sustained this country through difficult times, whether we agreed or disagreed with this decision or that, why did we change it? And under the current system, what does it add? I think that we all know that so much of the criticism and input now is sort of this outcome determinative effort. It's people who are simply saying we want a particular outcome from the courts. When a president thought of doing that, they call it court packing. I'm not from Texas or Oklahoma, but they have a Red River shootout between Oklahoma's football team and Texas's. And I ask people, if you're a big Oklahoma fan and the referees, who are the judges on the field, made a bad call the year before and he had to go through a confirmation process in Oklahoma, even though that could be a wonderful referee, how many people in the state of Oklahoma would vote to confirm that referee? Well, I dare say none. Simply because he made a call with which they disagreed and they would hope that they could get a different outcome in the future. And I don't think that's a good way to select judges. It doesn't express any sort of confidence in the system or in the way things had been done in the past. So I would go back. People say, what would I do to change the system? Why? I would ask the different question. What are we doing that improved the system that was in place for 200 years? And I dare say nothing.
Two more questions, one related. With the clarity of 2020 hindsight, if you could have anticipated the battle, would you have gone through with it?
I could, if I anticipated
it. If you could have anticipated what happened, if you could have anticipated the battle, would you have gone through with it, the confirmation process?
I don't think you have any alternative. I think that you're obligated. What are your choices? And that we send, some years ago I had these young kids who were wounded in Iraq. They had amputations and the wounds were fresh. They visited with me and spent some time. And they were apologizing for taking my time. And I'm looking at them. One had a missing eye. These are like 20-year-old kids. And when you think about it, we send them in harm's way to do their duty. And we get to whine about some criticism. I mean, look at me. I don't have any wounds. I think I would be an embarrassment in front of those kids if I ran for cover and if I hid.
Last question, and on a lighter note, and rather than interrupt the applause after he finishes, I want to tell you now that he will be signing, Justice Thomas will be signing books over here after he finishes, and there's also a website called mygrandfatherson.com, is that what it is, which I would urge all of you to occasionally visit. But the last question is, what book or books are you currently reading, and is Bill Callahan going to last the season?
Well, let me first of all express my unequivocal support for Coach Callahan and the staff. I don't cut and run. I thought that if he doesn't win one game, he's my coach. I think he's going to eventually turn it around if given the chance, and I would stand with him. I felt that way about Coach Solich also at the University of Nebraska and would have stood with him. I'm not in the middle of changing every time things are going bad, you change. My wife and I went through bad times, and I'm glad that we're together and we came out on the other side and we're closer now than ever. So I think everybody goes through bad times. Look, ask a Cub. I plan to read John Bolton's book, which I think would be an excellent read. My wife was reading it and telling me how good it is. Lynn Cheney's book I also plan to read. And I plan to get back to what I love reading. I love reading history, and I had gone on this sort of trip. I was reading the Austrian Economist. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with law, but it's kind of interesting. I don't know if you all have read Human Action or Socialism by von Mises, but it's really interesting, and that's what I want to get back to, the sort of odd, eclectic reading that I like. I would close by saying this. First of all, let me end where I started. I am honored to be here. I'm encouraged. The court is cloistered. We're there. We're shut away. And coming out here and meeting with people who are still trying to think, who are willing to stand up for their ideas and still believe that that document called our Constitution is still worth defending. These are my kind of people, and you're my kind of people. And I thank you all for honoring me with your presence and your kindness.